Now, this subject is a very wide one, potentially, you're telling me, which is rather what I thought when I was told what the final title of the talk I was scheduled to give was going to be. Now, workers' history, of course, can encompass a fairly wide variety of subject matter and you know, area of interest. We in the Socialist Party are, of course, you might think, most directly interested in social and political history. But of course, the everyday lives of workers and the general character of their lives and the way that has altered through the ages is of interest to us as well. Folk music is, to some extent, a contentious term. But I'm going to start off this talk before we actually get down to the nitty-gritty, as it were. Although, in my view, actually, this is, to some extent, is the nitty-gritty, because if you give a talk that is about folk music, you can't do it without illustration, I think. So I'm going to start off by playing you a few extracts of what is considered to be folk music. And before I do that, we can sort of generally define it, I think, as the traditional music of ordinary people. Now, that is a rather vague term, perhaps. We are equating folk music, or we're relating it, to workers' history. Well, it wouldn't be strictly true to say that folk music is only music of the workers, and in any case, it depends what you call the workers. Obviously, the people that we normally think of as workers in modern days are those who own nothing but their ability to work, etc. I mean, I think the chairman went into that in some detail. But people like peasants and, to some extent, small-owning farmers might come into that category. At any rate, all those people and clerks and apprentices and various types of people could be considered to be fairly ordinary people in society, as distinct from lords, ladies, bishops, etc. So, with that very brief and extremely sketchy definition, we'll give you a few extracts. Now, there are going to be four to start with, and the first one is a piece of rumbustious singing which I think might have been recorded in a pub. At any rate, it sounds as if it either was or ought to have been. So here we are with a guy who I think goes under the name of Cyril Poacher. That is, at any rate, his nickname. A splendid name, I think. He's singing a song. In fact, I don't actually have to tell you because it's introduced.
Hold up, please, ladies and gentlemen. I have my friend to call me old friend Mr. C. Feet of Blight with nothing. Hold up.
It's of a brisk young farmer who's ploughing of his land.
Of his land.
He called unto his horses to bid them gently stand. As he sit down upon his plough, all for a song to sing.
To sing.
His voice was so melodious, it made the valleys ring.
Away, my pal, round every round down valley, wait for the dear old day. And what will not that poor girl has, she threw them all away.
It's all this fair young damsel with nothing in the wood. His voice was so melodious, it charmed her as she stood.
As she stood.
She could no longer stay. And what fear not she had, poor girl, she threw them all away.
Away, my fair round, give me round, girl, darling, wait for the dear old day. And what fear not that poor girl, as she threw them all away.
One singer, one song, you might say. Now we have Paddy Tunney from Northern Ireland, who, as well as being a traditional singer, also did a large amount of collecting of other people's songs. And you may notice that this song has almost got an Oriental or Arabic sound about the tune. And I think that it's relevant to mention that. You know, I don't know how far we can go into the implications of that later on, but at any rate, you know, a lot of Irish music, a lot of the older Irish music has this quality about it. And so here we go with Where the Mountain Streams, Where the Moorcocks Crow.
With my doggin' gone through the blooming heather to seek for pastime, I took my way where I spied a lovely fair one. Her charms invited me a while to stay. I said, my darling, you will find I love you. Tell me your dwelling and your name also. Excuse my name and you'll find my dwelling near the mountain streams where the murkhangs crow.
Now that is very different, as you'll realise, from the previous example. And next we have an example of harmony singing. I sometimes wonder really whether harmony is the right word for what we're going to hear now. I'm not being entirely disparaging about it, but this is something which you either like or you don't like, I think. This is two members of the Copper family, who are a traditional singing family from Sussex, a farming family, who have got loads and loads of songs, actually, and you know, there's numerous ones being collected and written down in books and one thing and another. And this is one called The Banks, or a couple of verses from The Banks of the Sweet Primroses.
As I walked out one midsummer's morning, for to view the fields and to take the air, down by the banks of the sweet primroses, there I beheld a most lovely fair. Three long steps I stepped up to her, not knowing her as she passed me by. I stepped up to her, thinking for to view her. She appeared to me like some virtuous bride.
Now, finally, as far as British traditional music is concerned, we've got Jeannie Robertson, who is, I think, one of the more accomplished singers. The style of singing tends often to be very long, drawn out, and slow, but there's no two ways about it that, you know, without having been formally trained as a singer, she has reached quite a high standard of singing. This is an old classic ballad called My Son David. I might have a bit to say about it later on if we've got the time, but here we go. Just a bit of applause beforehand.
What's the blood that's on your sword, my son David? Oh, son David, what's the blood it's on your sword? Come, promise, tell me truth. Oh, that's the blood of my granny. Hey, Lady Mother, oh, Lady Mother, that's the blood of my granny, because it was me ruled by me.
Now, I've played these really to give you an idea of what the sound of, as it were, traditional music in the raw is. And some of that is rawer than others, I think. That gives you a fair example. I might say that folk music can also be said to include music like this.
Oh, I got that.
knew this moon. People had trouble with hope and career. Well, some of your friends and miss them. They don't know where they're over yonder. They don't know what there's over here.
And that was Lightning Hopkins, their black American blues singer. And the blues, of course, is a form of music which I think it's fair to say is still alive and well, albeit nowadays it's fairly electrified and, heavied up, as it were. That will give you a fair idea of the kind of area that you have to cover when you talk about folk music. And also it's worth saying that music hall is certainly regarded by many people in the folk scene as part of their area of interest, and it's a very interesting area of song. And also ragtime, although that really starts off as a sort of light classical music, so to speak. Now, you'll have noticed that, I think in the examples that I gave, most of the songs related in some way or other to love and sex. And of course this is something which is true of most musical cultures. This is true of most musical cultures. And certainly it's true of folk music. But often the dealing with love and sex is simply a pretext for dealing, or at any rate, if it's not a pretext, it's a means whereby other things can be dealt with. For example, let's take a song, and I'm now going to sing one to you, called Plough the Salt Wave. Now, this is a song which is quite clearly about something else other than love, although love is in fact the vehicle, as it were, for everything else. I think this song comes from the 18th century, if I've got it right. All things are quite silent, each mortal at rest, when me and my true love lie snug in one nest. When a bold set of ruffians broke into our cave, and they forced my dear jewel to plough the salt wave. I begged hard for my darling as I would for my life, but they'd not listen to me, although a fond wife, saying the kings must have sailors, to the seas he must go. And they left me lamenting in sorrow and woe. So there you get an example of a song which was about a custom. Which is about a custom which was rife in the 18th and 19th century, the press gang, where ordinary working people would be accosted and in back alleys and places like that by, say, about 12 to 20 rough sailor types who would then just haul them off on board ship, and they hadn't very much choice about it. Those were in the days when they needed the capitalism's wars needed to be fought, and they weren't too fussy about how they got their recruits very often, particularly in the Navy. Although also in the army you get the same sort of thing. You would get people being tricked into taking the king's shilling. The soldiers would meet them on the high road. There would be all this sort of jolly banter. They would get into the pub, and of course somebody would stick the shilling in the bottom of a pint glass. Once you'd drunk the pint, you had taken the king's shilling. And although I'm not going to sing any of it, a song Darling Jimmy, I think, is the only name I know it under. If you want to find some of the references to the songs that I'll not be giving you extracts from, I'll tell you later. That's in a Dick Gochen LP, suffice it to say. Now, I think that it's worth examining this question of sex, and indeed sex together with religion, because the two are actually fairly closely linked. That, incidentally, is not meant to be a sort of smart psychotherapist's point, although there might be some truth in the psychotherapeutic attitude to these things, as it was put forward by a non-psychotherapist in Peter Shaffer's play Equus, when the father of the hero says that all that religion is bad sex. Well, you know, you can actually speculate about that one. But it's fairly clear, for example, that many of the religious songs which come under the aegis of folk music, namely Christmas carols, were originally something else than Christian worship songs. Take a song, for example, like God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. Now, in a book called The Pagan Carols Restored by somebody called Norman Isles, who's a bloke who lives up in Morecambe, he goes into this subject and he points out, for example, that in God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, the last verse is rather like a verse from a wassailing song. I don't know if any of you know what I mean by a wassailing song, but those songs were sung when, you know, in midwinter time, basically. I think the 6th of January is the official day when you're supposed to sing them. But the peasants in a village would go around and they would sing and they would ask for money. And there were various customs associated with this, like in later centuries, you'd get guns fired off in orchards to frighten away evil spirits, to scare away the winter, in fact, and to, you know, bring back the spirit of growth and one thing. That's, at any rate, what it was originally for. And God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen is one example of a carol which was rewritten by church. I'm going to play you now a couple of verses from the restored version. And it's sung by a friend of mine, a wee bit hesitantly at times, I might say, but he is actually a pretty good singer when he's on his game, and he was recording this specially for me. So here we have Now Make You Merry Gentlemen, the first and last verses.
Now make you merry, gentlemen, let winter not dismay, for the sure sun does now return upon this very day. To keep us all from dark and cold, he has not gone away. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. Now to the sun sing praises, all you within this place, and like a loving company, each other do embrace. The heartfelt time of New Year is drawing on apace. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy.
So that is an example of the kind of thing that would originally have been sung in the early centuries, well, the middle centuries perhaps of the medieval period, and onto the late medieval period. Indeed, as Norman Isles puts it, between 1350 and 1550, which is incidentally described by the Encyclopaedia Britannica as the golden age of the English carol, there were no pious peasants overwhelmed with the purity of the Virgin Mary to compose Christmas carols. There were peasants overjoyed with the fertility of Mother Earth and Mother Eve, and celebrating them with songs and dances which shocked every ascetic priest in every village. Now, I think we've got to be careful with statements like this, because you can get to indulge in a sort of romanticism about this nature religion, which socialists would be just as opposed to this as they are to the less nature-based religions like Christianity. As I say, we've got to be careful about this, but there's certainly a lot in that. It's certainly the case that many of the customs which survive in folk music, Morris dancing and things like that, and dancing around the maypole, actually do relate to a far more self-confident celebration of sex and, you know, sort of manly and womanly power, as it were, which the church did everything in its power to tame and try to supersede. And a gradual process was carried out by the church. It had to be fairly gradual because there was a lot of resistance to it by the peasantry. There were 22 denunciations in the medieval period of folk song and dance as sin. And indeed, the word carol itself, the original Latin word is caraula, is supposed to have given rise to the word carouse. So you can see the the link that exists between, you know, what is regarded as indecent revelry and the sort of music of the ordinary people, authority trying to assert itself, the you know, the church trying to stamp its own doctrines and ideas on the minds of the peasantry. And to a large extent, of course, they succeeded. By about 1600, a lot of the knowledge of what these customs had been about had gone. Now, so far as I've already alluded to the fact that sex and love are used as in company, perhaps, with other things. And this is just as true of social and political subjects in folk songs as it is of anything else. And for example, we should turn now, I think, to a song from the last century called The Handloom Weaver. Now, The Handloom Weaver is a song which the narrative voice in this song, the guy who's actually telling you the story, as it were, is evidently someone who's trained as a handloom weaver, but who has grown up in the time of the factory looms and the power looms, and who, you know, can see the fact that these are superseding his father's old trade. And indeed, in a Scottish version of this song, it's put very succinctly. It's a Scottish version, although it's done in standard English, apparently, and the words go something like, "But the daily portion of my father's age has faded now to a meagre wage, and the dark mill factories of Anderstown have brought the prices and the weavers down." Well, that about sums it up, of course. But as I say, the Handloom Weaver is ostensibly a love song, and it contains things like, "Pleasant thoughts came to my mind as I turned down her sheets so fine, and I seen her two breasts standing so, like two white hills all covered with snow." And that is the factory maid with whom he's fallen in love. And his father says to him, another part in the song, "How can you say it's a pleasant bed when nought lies there but a factory maid?" "Factory lass although she be," replies the son, "blessed is the man that enjoys she." The grammar wasn't too good either. But songs like that are, you know, fairly common. Songs which denote the passing of one age, really, the age of craftsmanship, and the coming of another age, the age of modern industrialisation. But work in the age before modern industrialisation was something which is quite often celebrated. Even although it was the hard conditions of work were, you know, recognised and alluded to and all the rest of it. And a lot of harvest songs, for example, have this sort of thing about them. For example, there's a song called Johnny Sangster, which I think is of 18th century origin, and the first few lines of it are, "Of all the seasons o' the year when we men work the sairest, the harvest is the hardest time, and yet it is the rarest." So the kind of work that agricultural workers had to do, whilst it could be hard, and whilst they would often complain about being ground down by their masters, was at least a fairly enjoyable kind of work in itself. It was something that could be organised more according to the, you know, the way you wanted to organise it. There was a bit more freedom involved in it, perhaps. And to some extent, this has survived up into the present day in certain occupations. Occupations which are among the hardest, like fishing and whaling, for example. And you get songs, and I'll sing you one just shortly, about going to sea to catch whales and fish, which, you know, tell you about the hard conditions, which nevertheless seem to display a sort of pride in the fact that these guys have withstood this sort of hard life that they have to undergo and, you know, have come out on top, as it were. So I'll sing you... Is there any more water over? I'll sing you a song now called The Greenland Whale Catchers, which comes almost certainly from the last century. "On the 23rd of March, me boys, from England we set sail, crying heaven above protect us with a sweet and a pleasant gale. We never was downhearted, boys, nor let our courage fail, but we bore off unto Greenland, looking out for Greenland whale, looking out for Greenland whale." And when that we come to Greenland, where the icy winds do blow, we tacked about all in the north, all among the frost and snow. Our fingertips were frozen off, and likewise our toenails, as we crawled out on deck, my boys, looking out for Greenland Whale, looking out for Greenland Whale. And when that we come to Ymez, where the mountains flowed with snow, we tacked about all in the north till we see the whale fish blow. And when we catch that whale, my boys, then homewards we will steer. We'll make those valleys for to ring with drinking of strong beer. We'll make those lofty alehouses in London town to roar. And when that our money is all gone, to Greenland go for more, to Greenland go for more. So as I say there, you can see the celebration of hard work well done and overcome. It's not all like that, of course. And although I'm not going to give you an example of it, there are definitely songs which tell of the harsh treatment meted out either to ships' companies in general or to particular individuals. And in the latter category, there's a song which is either called Andrew Rose or Andrew Ross, depending on where the singer happens to come from, that they collected it from. And that tells of, you know, a most disgraceful episode where a ship's captain simply took a dislike to somebody and treated him with, as he was well able to, being the master, the lord and master of his ship, treated him with the most vicious cruelty. So, as I say, these work songs very often contain, the ones that you get before industrialisation, very often contain a sort of, once again, a self-confident air to them. The songs, however, that you tend to get after industrialisation is well and truly set in are of a rather different type. Although you can sometimes still get people celebrating the fact that they have worked and worked well, there's far more of an attitude of being governed by the clock and resenting it, and you know the machine is in charge rather than you. And for example, a song like Poverty Knock, which is a song from Yorkshire, will gives that, and just to quote two lines from it: poverty, poverty knock, me loom it is saying all day. And then it goes on to say, I know I can guttle when I hear my shuttle go poverty, poverty knock. The word guttle means eat, or guzzle perhaps, in Southern English. And the general sort of upshot of that song is that, in fact, it's the worker's poverty goes hand in hand with the right to stay alive. So, you know, it's paradoxically your poverty which guarantees your survival. This is, of course, something which is still, even though it may be covered up in many ways or people may have been made unaware of it, this is still something, of course, which dominates us in modern capitalist society. Now, I want to come on to discuss the folk revival. This talk isn't a very coherent or comprehensive talk because all that I felt I was able to do was offer you some thoughts on these subjects. And, I hope that I've given you something to think about and something to discuss in the discussion period. And indeed, that's really the time when we should get on to the real work of the session. But the folk revival, there's been two of them, in fact. In the early years of this century, an interest was shown in folk music by people who certainly either regarded themselves as middle class or upper class, or who at any rate were certainly of a literary or academic bent, and who regarded themselves as being definitely different from the peasants and workers whose music they tried to investigate, whose music incidentally they sincerely wanted to preserve and keep for posterity. But I say that, but I think it should be realised that the motives behind the first folk revival were fairly dubious from our point of view. I think they were all fairly dubious, not all, but many of the motives were fairly dubious. For example, Cecil Sharp and Vaughan Williams definitely saw themselves as being interested in trying to find a national music, a national British music, which could perhaps be taught in schools and which could instill in the school kids a sense of their own national identity, and which, you know, would encourage them to think of themselves as different, and do it through the medium of songs, which contained information about customs, which, you know, the customs of foreigners would not appeal to them so much, according to these academics and literarians. But it has to be said that these people did a lot of very good work in preserving the traditional music and actually rescuing it from the oblivion into which it might have fallen had it not been for people like this. So I think that they're due some thanks for that, and I'll try and say a bit more about why they're due some thanks for it later on. But for example, you would get things like this. Vaughan Williams composed a folk song suite, and one of the movements from it starts something like this. About that is that that helped to popularise folk music, to sort of start people's interest in it, that sort of stuff. Whilst it's a very tidied up sort of way of presenting folk music, and, you know, some people are dubious about any attempt to present folk music in any other way than what they regard as the traditional way. Of course, there isn't really such a thing as the traditional way, because the tradition itself was a fairly flexible and dynamic thing. Otherwise, how would the tenor banjo have ever become an established part of Irish traditional music? The banjo, as some of you may know, is originally an African instrument, and it travelled through black Americans, and indeed white Americans, and became modified in various ways. But, as I say, this folk revival certainly helped to preserve a lot of the music, but it ran out of steam to some extent. It ended up in the formation, or one of its main products, rather, was the formation of the English Folk Dance and Song Society, which is still going, though I think it sort of totters along quite a bit, financially speaking. You know, they keep having monetary difficulties of one kind or another. I think the second folk revival, the one which started in the 1950s and which we're really still in, is the more interesting one. The second folk revival was, to a large extent, started by Bert Lloyd, A.L. Lloyd, and Ewan McCall, and various other people, and for two reasons, basically. First of all, because the music that they were interested in, and which, you know, to some extent had already been documented, was the music, as A.L. Lloyd put it, largely of lower-class people. And secondly, because they were all dismayed at the effect that American rock and roll culture was having on British music. They wanted to resurrect something British, to get a truly British, Scottish, English, Irish and Welsh type of music about, to counteract the bad effects, as they saw, of this Americanized culture. Now, one folk singer, Ian Campbell, has put it rather succinctly, when he said of Elvis Presley that he thought he had managed to convert masturbation into an art form. Well, you know, you can think what you like of that. I'm not a fan of Elvis myself, although I like rock and roll, I've got to say. Indeed, it's worth pointing out to anybody who gets too precious about the relationship between folk music and rock and roll that Buddy Holly, for example, always thought that the music he performed was just country music with drums. And of course, there was no distinction between country music and folk music up until, well, relatively recent times, when we have now a distinct thing called country and western music, which I once heard somebody rather ridiculously describe as the working man's folk music. That is a disastrous prospect, in my view. If that was the folk music of the workers, then, you know, frankly, although there is good country in Western music, certainly the British variety tends to be pretty awful. Now, Ewan McCall is an interesting character in himself, and I think socialists ought to really spend a wee bit of time thinking about him and people like him, such as Leon Russellson. And although this is not the sort of remark that socialists should make too often, nor the sort of attitude which they should display, I think it's worth saying that, to some extent, McCall in his life and work has really encapsulated a lot of the folk tradition and the folk revival. He fell heir, as it were, to the tradition, insofar as his mother used to sing the Scotch ballads as she did the housework, and, you know, he heard them and liked them and was interested in them. And he has himself written songs, many of which have been directly taken from traditional songs. You may be interested to know, those of you who don't already know, that he wrote the song which Roberta Flack got to number one with, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. And the tune of that song was taken by a process of rewriting, as it were, from a traditional tune called The Verdant Braes of Skreen. But McCall has been so successful in the songs that he's written. For example, him and Charles Parker did a series of radio programmes called the Radio Ballads. And the Radio Ballads went into various subjects connected with work and the lives of ordinary people. There was ones like Singing the Fishing, for example, or the Ballad of John Axelrod, I think I've got that right, Axenrod rather, which dealt with railway workers and things of that kind. And McCall was so successful in the songs that he wrote that very often the traditional singers he took them back to thought they recognised them. So that is an area which some people have had a wee bit more to say about, but I won't dwell on that fact. There's no doubt about it that songs, for example, like Only Doing Their Job, which is a fairly recent composition by Ewan McCall, and songs like Legal Illegal are, for socialists, among the best political material that has been written in these days. And of course, Leon Russellson, the other person I particularly mentioned, has also written songs which would stand up to examination by socialists, even though both McCall and Russellson, in their actual political opinions, are dubious from our point of view. Now, I've spent a bit of time talking about this particular area of the folk revival because I think it's interesting, it's necessary to make a few points about it. First of all, there's a lot that's good about it from the point of view of workers' history, because workers should know, ordinary people should know. I won't go so far as to say they ought to know and be moralistic about it, but in my view, they should have a knowledge of their own cultural history. And folk music, the music of peasants and industrial workers, is precisely part of that, their cultural history, and that you can learn a lot through the agency of folk music. You can actually fill out your knowledge a bit or get different perspectives on the historical events and historical periods that you studied at school. So that's one good point about it. There are, however, the bad sides of it. The nationalism, which is definitely quite evident in the folk revival. I mean, McCall, for all his apparent socialist knowledge, is definitely a nationalist. He, for example, I heard him complaining about the far too cosmopolitan nature of modern culture. But the trouble with this kind of objection to modern culture is that it ignores the fact that folk music itself, whilst being a local product and to some extent, I suppose, a national product, although that's always a fairly dubious description in my view, whilst it's a local product, it's the more that you study the folk music of different countries, the more you find out that there are points of contact, and sometimes you even get exactly the same story, for example, told in one part of the world that you previously heard from another part of the world. And of course that shouldn't surprise us, because the lives of workers, by definition, have a lot in common wherever they happen to come from. The nationalism that does go on in the folk revival, however, sometimes takes a rather vague form, a vague but nevertheless dubious form. For example, songs like The New St. George, or All Right Jack, I think is one that I heard recently from a group called The Home Service. Well, that should tell you quite a bit about them, I think. You know, it strikes me that this sort of populist English nationalism, and it's more, I think it's more evident in England, maybe it's just because I'm living down here, but it's more evident on the English folk scene, to me anyway, that this kind of populist nationalism. This, of course, is something which we have to strenuously oppose. And I think I've spoken for long enough, really, and I'm going to end up by saying, by throwing out to all of you with any pretensions in this line, and I include myself here, that what we should be doing in respect of folk music, what socialists should actually be doing in respect of folk music and workers' history, is actually getting down and writing the songs instead of having to rely on people like McCall and Roslison, good as they are, to provide us with the excellent material that they do provide us with. And on that point, I think I'll end.